Another important area, the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth that are based on powerful mythologies describing deities or some kind of heroic figures who underwent death and rebirth. So those are stories of Isis and Osiris in Egypt, the story of the goddess Inanna in the Sumerian culture, descending into the underworld to find the elixir of life for her dead lover. Dionysus, Attis, Adonis, some of these mythologies are not death and rebirth, but descend into the underworld. The most famous variety is the Eleusinian variety, Eleusinian mysteries, held in Athens every 5 years for a period of almost 2,000 years. Now the question is, what were they offering here that they could keep the attention of the ancient world for a period of 2,000 years? There's an interesting book by Albert Hofmann, the discoverer of LSD, Gordon Wasson, the man who brought the Mexican magic mushrooms to Europe from Mexico, and Karl Ruck, who is a Greek scholar. They wrote a book called The Road to Eleusis, where they, after years of scholarly research, concluded that this was actually a psychedelic religion, that the key to the experiences of these mysteries was a ritual drink, which was called Kykeon, K-Y-K-E-O-N, and they found out that this was an ergot preparation, which means it was very closely related to LSD. Now, there were many, many outstanding prominent personalities who were initiated in these death-rebirth mysteries. Plato and Aristotle were initiates and wrote about these mysteries. Cicero, the Roman statesman and philosopher, Pindaros, the poet, Euripides, the playwright, Alcibiades, the military leader. Now, this had to have an incredible impact on Greek cultural life, you know, to every 5 years conducting the mysteries. What I didn't mention, what I found out during my visit in Eleusis, or Eleusis as the Greeks pronounce it, was the number of initiates. There's a gigantic hall, which is now in ruins, called the Telestrion, where this was happening. And the number of people who were initiated every 5 years was over 3,000 people. So if you take 3,000 people from a relatively small world, which the world was at that time, and some of those people would be in the category of Plato and Aristotle, I mean, you have certainly done something to the cultural life of that time. So this is a chapter in Greek history, and we can say also in the cultural history of Europe, because we see Greece as the kind of a cradle of the European civilization that has been vastly underestimated. And the last context that I would like to mention here is, of course, the whole vast area of spiritual practices. I already mentioned the different schools of yoga, the different forms of Buddhism, from Theravada to Zen and Vajrayana, Taoism, Christian mysticism, particularly Hesychasm, the Jesus prayer, the Kabbalistic exercises, alchemy, the way it was understood by Carl Gustav Jung, as a psychospiritual process, not as a process of making gold out of base metals and so on. So again, that's an enormously vast domain in which these different spiritual systems developed mind-altering technologies, technologies of the sacred inducing these holotropic states. So there's no way of understanding the ritual and spiritual history of humanity without really knowing something about non-ordinary states, because that is the source of religion, visionary transpersonal experiences of the founders of the religion, of the saints, of the prophets. So I've already briefly alluded to the great difference between the Western industrial civilization and all native, pre-industrial, ancient cultures as far as the attitude to these holotropic states of consciousness is concerned. That all these pre-industrial cultures held these holotropic states in very high esteem. And they spent a lot of time and energy trying to develop effective and safe ways of inducing these states, and they were systematically using them as main vehicles for their ritual and spiritual life, and for a variety of other things, which I already mentioned. Certainly for diagnosing diseases and healing, for cultivating extrasensory perception and intuition, for artistic inspiration, but also for practical purposes, finding lost objects or finding lost people or following the movement of the animals that they hunted. For Australian Aborigines, you know, finding where it's going to rain in the next few hours on their territory and so on. Now, in comparison with the situation in these native pre-industrial cultures, we have the attitude of the industrial cultures, which basically have rejected anything associated with non-ordinary states of consciousness. We have pathologized them, and we have even outlawed some of the means and some of the contexts in which they can occur or by which they can be induced. Now, what this means, that we have basically pathologized the entire ritual and spiritual history of humanity, because all major religions began with visionary transpersonal experiences. We can look at the history of the Buddha, you know, his 6 years of ascetic practice, his experience under the Bo tree, where he had the experience of the visitation of Kamamara and his army, and then his experience of enlightenment under the Bo tree, and on another occasion, the experience of past lives and liberation from the karmic bonds and so on. These are all powerful transpersonal experiences that current psychology and psychiatry would consider to be psychotic. When we look at the Bible, both the Old and the New Testament, again, we have the experience that Abraham had with God and the angel, and the experience of Moses and Jehovah in the burning bush, and the temptation of Jesus in the desert by the devil, the experience of Saul, the blinding vision of Jesus on the way to Damascus, the experience of Saint John, the apocalyptic vision that he had on the island of Patmos in his cave. Those are all powerful mystical experiences. The so-called miraculous journey of Muhammad, where he had the vision of Archangel Gabriel, who took him on this trip through the seven heavens into the Muslim paradise and into Gehenna, into hell, and his experience with Allah when he got the articles of the Quran in a state that was described as ecstasy approaching annihilation. In the same way, the Mormon religion is based on a direct visionary experience, and certainly many other religious systems. Now, Western psychiatry attributes these experiences to psychosis. We have many articles, many books which talk about the best possible diagnosis for just about every founder of a major religion or a saint or a prophet. Saint Teresa of Avila was called a hysterical psychotic. Saint John of the Cross has been called hereditary degenerative. Ramakrishna's experiences were attributed to psychosis. Muhammad's experiences were attributed to epilepsy because he had some kind of seizure-like manifestations. Anthropologists have been discussing what would be the best diagnosis for shamans. Are they schizophrenics? Are they ambulant psychotics? Are they severe hysterics? Are they maybe also epileptics because they have some kind of a seizure-like manifestations? There is even one paper by Franz Alexander, one of the founders of psychosomatic medicine, a famous psychoanalyst, where even meditation is pathologized. He wrote a paper called The Buddhist Training as Artificial Catatonia. Now, if this is true, that the experiences of these people were nothing but schizophrenic, psychotic experiences, how do we explain that they had such a powerful impact, that they inspired millions of more or less normal people, that they inspired incredible architecture, incredible art, paintings, music, sculptures, and that they were such a driving force of human history? We can't imagine that this would be possible unless the whole transpersonal spiritual dimension is an extremely relevant dimension in the depths of the human psyche. Now, I would like to from here go to Michael Harner, who's an anthropologist of good academic standing, who also had a shamanic initiation when he worked in the Amazon. And he, in his book, The Way of the Shaman, looks at Western psychology and psychiatry and says that they're biased in two different ways. One of these biases he calls ethnocentric, which means this is a perspective on the human psyche and mental health and disease held and developed by one particular group of people, which is the industrial civilization. And this group considers its own perspective to be absolutely superior to any other group who has ever existed throughout history. And everything that these people are doing that doesn't make sense to us in terms of Freudian analysis of behaviorism would be seen as either superstition, primitive magical thinking, or if it involves direct experiences of spiritual realities, it would be seen as gross pathology. The second bias that Michael Harner talks about, he calls cognicentric. Probably a better word would be pragmacentric. What he means by that is that when we were formulating our psychological theories, we took into consideration only experiences and observations made in the ordinary states of consciousness. And we have systematically censored out everything that came out from the study of non-ordinary states, whether it came from historians, people doing comparative religion, from anthropologists, or even from our contemporary research, like anything that has been written in psychedelic literature. Everything has been written off. None of it has been taken into consideration. Everything that parapsychologists have described and discovered. Everything coming from experiential forms of psychotherapy, from transpersonal psychology, but then particularly from thanatology, where we have very fascinating observations suggesting, for example, that it's possible for people who are in an out-of-body state, a disembodied consciousness, can have accurate perception of not only the immediate environment, but also frequently from a very remote environment. And this can happen even with people who are congenitally blind and have never seen anything in their whole life. So now the question arises, what would be then psychiatry and psychology that would not be ethnocentric, that would be applicable to all human groups and would be culturally sensitive? It would be treating with respect ritual and spiritual life of different cultures. And also psychology and psychiatry that would not be cognicentric or pragmacentric. That means it would really systematically study and incorporate the experiences and the observations from non-ordinary states. So I can think here about maybe four or five different areas in which we would have to radically change our thinking, and we will explore them all in some detail. The first one is we would need a much larger cartography of the psyche. Our current cartography is limited to postnatal biography, things that happened to us in infancy, childhood, and later, and to the Freudian so-called individual unconscious, which is also in a way related to postnatal biography. We would need a much, much bigger image of the human psyche, a very different model. We would also, and this is the second area where we would have to change our thinking, we would see very differently what it means to have emotional and psychosomatic disorders, what they mean and how deep their roots reach. We would get a very different understanding about the dynamics of healing, of therapy. What kind of experiences are healing, transforming, evolutionary? Is it really just analyzing our postnatal life through free associations and analysis of transference or some other verbal therapy, or are there some other more powerful healing mechanisms that become available? We would have to change, and this is the third area, our understanding of spirituality, see spirituality as a normal and legitimate dimension in the human psyche and in the universal scheme of things. We would also have to develop a different understanding of what is the most appropriate strategy of self-exploration and therapy. At this point, we have an enormous number of schools that have fundamental disagreements about some of the most basic issues, like how does the psyche function, why do the symptoms develop, what they mean, and also what do we do to influence them therapeutically. And the last category where we would have to really change our thinking would be extremely broad. This would change not just our view of psychology and psychiatry, but it would change the philosophy of Western science. This would have to do with some real fundamental understanding of reality, particularly in relation to the nature, origin, and function of consciousness. Is consciousness really just an accidental product of matter, of the neurophysiological processes in the brain, or is it a fundamental dimension, an irreducible dimension of existence? Now, we actually now have a psychology that transcend somehow the ethnocentric and the cognocentric bias that Michael Harner talked about. And I already mentioned something about my involvement with Abraham Maslow and Tony Sutic. It is a transpersonal psychology. It is a psychology that quite explicitly includes the spiritual dimension as an important and relevant dimension of the psyche, and one that studies the entire spectrum of human experience, including various forms of non-ordinary states of consciousness. It is an attempt, a major attempt, to synthesize and marry, in a way, what we know as science with the spiritual traditions, to create a kind of a new, comprehensive, overarching worldview that would integrate the best of science and the best of spirituality. So we will now explore in more detail the areas which I mentioned earlier as areas where we have to really do some kind of major overhaul of our thinking. The first area where we have to make some fundamental revisions is the model of the psyche that we have, our idea about the dimensions of human consciousness, or the cartography of the unconscious. When we work with non-ordinary states, we cannot do it with the map that is limited to postnatal biography and the Freudian unconscious. We will see that sooner or later, people will transcend somehow the boundaries of Freudian analysis, and they will be moving into various areas that simply have not been accounted for or have not been explored in the Freudian approach. We find them in some of the renegades, like Otto Rank, who emphasized the trauma of birth, or Carl Gustav Jung, who brought in the concept of the collective unconscious and the archetypes, the mythological dimensions of the psyche, Sándor Ferenczi, who brought in the phylogenetic dimension, that maybe the deepest craving we have is to return back to the ocean from which life once came, and so on. But these were renegades who were actually either expelled from the psychoanalytic movement or left themselves, and whose teaching has not been incorporated into mainstream psychology. Now, when I saw that this work cannot be done with the limited maps that I inherited from psychoanalysis, I spent about 3 years just sitting in people's sessions and registering the experiences, keeping records and asking people to write accounts of their experiences, and carefully mapping these categories, the different types of experiences and the different levels of experiences. And I created a cartography that has not just the biographical level, which it more or less shares with traditional psychology, but includes two additional domains. One of these domains I call perinatal. Peri literally means around or near, and natalis in Latin means pertaining or related to childbirth. So those are experiences that have something to do, that are closely related to the trauma of birth, to the biological birth process. And then the second large domain we now call transpersonal, which includes many different categories of experiences which share as their common characteristic the fact that we transcend somehow the usual boundaries of the body ego, or what Alan Watts called the skin-encapsulated ego. So I will now say a little something about these two additional domains. I will leave out the biographical domain, because that's something that has been thoroughly explored by conventional psychiatry and psychology. Now, when we work with non-ordinary states, sooner or later, people will transcend the biographical domain, the domain of postnatal biography, and they will start having powerful experiences. They will feel suddenly confined, trapped. They will feel that their life is threatened. They might have pains, pressures, experience suffocation and so on, and experience somehow fight for liberation, fight for life. And they have visions frequently which somehow bring in the themes of being born, but also themes of dying and aging. But they primarily focus on this beginning of life and end of life. So as we experience this confinement, we might have the feeling that we are trapped in the womb, struggling to be born, but at the same time encountering death. Our life is threatened. Now, this reflects the fact that in many deliveries, life of the child can be threatened to different degrees. And even the easiest delivery means death of the fetal existence, which is existence of being an aquatic creature, quite different from the postnatal existence where we are air-breathing creatures. But during the passage through the birth canal, life can actually be significantly threatened. And it's reflected in the fact that on the perinatal level, we have experiences which integrate in a very interesting way both death and birth. When people have these experiences come in four experiential clusters. I refer to them as basic perinatal matrices that are meaningfully related to the consecutive stages of biological birth. So for example, the first matrix is related to the situation of the child still in the womb. Now we can have an actual concrete memory of being the fetus in the womb, a sense of the amniotic fluid that we can feel and we can even taste, the sense of being connected with the mother through the umbilical cord, and experiencing this sort of protected and blissful state of the undisturbed prenatal life. If there are disturbances, we can experience that our life is threatened, that we are being poisoned, because many of the disturbances are chemical in nature in the prenatal life. Or if it's something like a mechanical attempt at abortion, it could be an experience of a kind of bloody apocalyptic catastrophe, end of the world, and so on. Or some of the prenatal disturbances can be associated with visions of demons, and so on. The positive prenatal experiences can open from the prenatal, from the fetal, into the oceanic. We can go from an experience of being a fetus to becoming a whale or a dolphin or being in the ocean, being the ocean. They can also open into space. We can experience ourselves as being in the cosmos or identifying even with an astronaut in a weightless condition on a spacewalk, floating and being connected with the pipeline to the mothership, as it is called, and so on. We can experience a connection with beautiful nature, mother nature that provides being in And the fourth matrix, then, is the experience of what we call death rebirth, and so on. So the main and after spheres, perhaps, is even the start to be from the best of the spheres, which are all taken from my reading, me less being, meaning myself, take be the or, and be a few minutes, so you can have a few minutes, which is the situation of the life in the ordinary stage. Even with some hand, because I'm planting to ask all sense of the of again being out of me, or I'm far, so it is in the east, and not in the neurotropic state, we can accept it. The ghost in Spencer and just the shoulders are to take three of the ship. We have the brothers for it, such as some water at Iceman is estimating. Very large For example, we can work on asthma. Biographical roots of it could be a situation of near drowning when we were 7 years old, a deeper level experience of whooping cough when we were 2 years old. The perinatal component of it would be the choking in the birth canal when the shoulder was stuck behind the pubic bone of the mother. And then the deepest roots of asthma could be past life experiences involving something like strangulation or hanging. And in order to effectively work through that problem, we have to allow ourselves and be allowed to confront all the different levels that contribute to that disorder. The next one is the radically different understanding of spirituality. In the mechanistic, materialistic worldview, there is obviously no space for spirituality. Spirituality means gullibility, superstition, lack of education, primitive magical thinking, emotional immaturity, sort of not having coped with the infantile images of our parents and so on. And direct experiences of spiritual realities would be seen as gross pathology, as psychosis. There's no distinction in traditional psychiatry between a mystical experience and a psychotic experience. From this perspective that we are discussing here, spirituality has something to do with the depths to which we have experienced ourselves. When our process of self-exploration reaches at least the perinatal level, but then definitely when it reaches the transpersonal level, our experiences will have a quality that Jung called, and he actually used the term of Otto Rudolph, Jung liked the term, will have the quality of numinosity, will have a sense that we are now relating to something that belongs to another dimension of reality, to a higher order, something that is supraordinated to this one, something that traditionally would be called holy, sacred, mystical, and so on. Jung didn't like these terms because they're heavily loaded and they're kind of prone to misunderstanding. He preferred this neutral term. So we have to distinguish here spirituality and religion. Spirituality has something to do with direct experience of the transpersonal dimensions of reality. Religion is an organized activity that originally was inspired by visionary experiences, but that for many mainstream religions historically has very little to do with spiritual experience and has much more to do with organized group activity, with things like concern about hierarchies, possessions, imposing moral codes on people. It's possible to imagine a religion which has no spirituality in it, and it's possible, easy to imagine spirituality that is not connected to religion. The next important category where we have to change our understanding has something to do with the strategy of self-exploration and the strategy of therapy. And this is an extremely important issue. The reason for this is that we have such a jungle, such an incredibly rich market of different schools of psychotherapy, including a group of them which all are subsumed under the term depth psychology and are really derived from Freudian psychoanalysis. And they all present very different perspectives on how the psyche functions, why the symptoms are there, what they mean. And each of them also offers a very different strategy. What do we do? They offer different techniques to work with the clients to fix them, to sort of change their psychological functioning so that it is normalized according to the perspective of that particular school. Now, if we have a problem, then we can just simply flip a coin and we can choose a school. And with each school, there will be a different story for what's wrong with us, and will be offered a very different approach to achieve somehow alleviation of the symptoms. It's a very peculiar situation, which is in a way unique. We don't have 50 schools of chemistry where the chemists would argue, you know, what happens when you put two substances into the test tube. And what's even stranger is that those of us who work in the profession, in psychology or in psychiatry, very frequently don't even question it, that there is something wrong here, something problematic. When we are beginning professionals, we simply look at this market and we feel attraction to one particular system. Like for me, it was Freudian analysis. And we get training in that particular system. If we are not satisfied with it, we just get training in another system which might have a very different set of assumptions. Now, the interesting thing here is that we don't have any statistical studies that would tell us that clearly one psychotherapeutic system is better than another. Those studies are not easy to do, and those studies that have been done discovered something very interesting. which is that in each school you find good therapists and bad therapists, therapists who have better results and worse results. But generally, the results of the therapies using verbal means are not terribly impressive in the first place. But within that range, there are sort of good therapists and bad therapists working with the same premises. And these studies have shown that very likely their results, the results they're getting, have very little to do with what they think they're doing, the tech playing, the kind of interpretation they give, the timing of those interpretations, the content of those, because they're very equal to another. If there was a clear dependence on the conceptual and on the use of technique, the situation couldn't exist. So we see that there is something operating in these verbal forms of psychotherapy that very likely has very little to do with what therapists think they are, with the theoretics of this. And that thing that is very difficult to formulate scientifically. So some of the things that have been emphasized, for example, were things like the quality of the human encounter between the therapist and the client, the feeling of the client of being unconditionally accepted by another human being, or even the sense of being loved, that these could be the most important mechanisms that are operating here. So the interesting question is, what kind of insights do we get into this very unsatisfactory situation in psychotherapy when we work with non-ordinary states? Basically, what we find here confirms somehow something that Jung actually formulated. According to Jung, it is in principle impossible to use our intellect to understand the psyche of another person or even our own. The reason for this is that the intellect is just a partial function. For Jung, the psyche is something that is cosmic. He talks about anima mundi. So our individual psyche is kind of teased out of this much larger universal matrix. So the intellect is not equipped to understand the psyche, which is a much larger phenomenon than the intellect. So the alternative that Jung offers is what we can do. We can somehow create a protective environment, and the Jungian psychology uses here the image of the hermetic vessel in which the alchemical transformation happens. We can offer a certain technique, which for Jung was the analysis of dreams and the active imagination, which was basically continuation of the dream from the night. And then we create a situation in which the conscious ego can get into a kind of a dialogue using symbolic means with a higher aspect of ourselves, which he called self, with capital S, which is connected to the collective unconscious and has the kind of the wisdom of ages, which surpasses the knowledge of any individual therapist or any individual school. And so the healing happens under sort of guidance of the inner healing principle. Jung talked about the individuation process. The self has a certain plan for us. It's guiding us towards a certain goal if we let it. Very much confirmed in states where we environment, we a technique, one of the technologies they talked about, that will change the person. And in the holotropic state, then something like an inner radar, which will phrase in the psyche, with strong emotional, which automatically bring them for praying, transform them in conscious experience. And in this process, which is associated by the inner intelligence, the symptoms will be some test therapist, sense of intelligent, open or co-editor, not somebody who is guiding us anyway, but who is intelligently supporting what happened, the original meaning of capitalist, which means somebody assists in the healing process. And then we have the last category in which major changes happen. When Buddhists with no states will encounter experiences and obstacles which cannot be accounted for as we adhere to the philosophy of Western science, to the materialistic, mechanistic model, and we need a new paradigm. We need a sort of fundamentally different understanding of reality, particularly in regard to the nature and function of consciousness. We cannot see anymore consciousness as something that emerged as an accidental byproduct out of the complexity of the neurophysiological processes in the brain, but we start seeing it as a fundamental and primary, irreducible aspect of existence. And again, this is something that we will explore at some length in later sessions. At this point, I would like to look once more at the ancient and pre-industrial cultures, the native cultures on the one side, and the Western civilization. Other groups see that they have different world of modern science discovered many aspects of the micro world and the macro world that the native cultures, the ancient cultures, didn't know anything about. But that's not the major difference between those two worldviews. This is something that would be expected. This is something that comes with progress and accumulation of human knowledge. There is one difference which is much more astonishing, which is the difference concerning the spiritual dimension of reality. That for the native cultures, a very, very real, for science and since for television in general, has been questioned or seen as extinct. And this is attributed to the purity of Western. The spiritual vision is interpreted that these native cultures, the cultures didn't know enough about the world, and they were afraid of death, they were afraid of impermanence, and this is why they created sort of as a kind of wish-fulfilling system, this whole spiritual perspective. Now, when we look at it closer, we'll see that the reason is very, very different and has to do with the attitude to holotropic states of consciousness. Because people from the ancient and the pre-industrial cultures systematically used non-ordinary states of consciousness as part of their ritual and spiritual life, so that large numbers of the members of these cultures had repeated first-hand experience of the holotropic realities, and their worldview somehow had to be a synthesis of what they experience in everyday life through the mediation of the senses, and also what they experience in these holotropic states. Whereas we have rejected and pathologized the holotropic states, we don't use or even allow some of the means that could induce these states, and when people start having these experiences spontaneously, we find ways of suppressing them. People get left, people get hospitalized, so that the experience observation from holotropic states not find somehow the way into Western view. What I have observed repeatedly that people from our, no matter their view, no matter their education background, no matter what their specialization is, when they have the opportunity to have powerful transpersonal experiences, they will not accept the what has been referred to as the Cartesian Newtonian materialistic worldview anymore, and their worldview starts shifting in the direction of the great mystical traditions, in the direction of the Eastern spiritual philosophies, and in many instances, even in the direction of the worldview of the native cultures. So somehow, the difference in these two worldviews in relation to the existence or non-existence of the spiritual dimensions really doesn't reflect somehow the superiority of Western materialistic science, but more our own naivete in relation to these non-ordinary states of consciousness and what they have to offer. Now, what we are talking about here is something that has tremendous significance. It's not just a matter of academic interest. It has very, very deep and very serious implications for our everyday life. So it is really essential for us to decide whether the transpersonal vision really reflects an existing dimension of reality, whose practical application of the transpersonal vision could really transform our individual life and have even much larger sort of collective implications. It certainly could provide much more effective ways of healing emotional and psychosomatic disorders and make our life much more satisfying, much more rewarding, open up new sources of creativity, but also provide some strategies that could help us to change the situation in the world. If enough people would pursue this path, this could mean a significant alleviation of the global crisis that we are all facing and that endangers not only the future of humanity, but possibly even the survival of life on this planet. So these are some of the issues that we'll be exploring in the next sessions.
This concludes tape 1. Our program continues tape 2.